You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Custer, digital editor at Times Higher Education. What does the notion of genius mean? And is it something that universities should be looking for when they're searching for talent? Well, at the recent World Academic Summit in Zurich, Nobel laureate astrophysicist Brian Schmidt interviewed rising star physicist Sabrina Pastirsky about her career. If you don't know about Sabrina, she started as an undergrad at MIT, then moved on to do a PhD at Harvard, and is now starting a postdoc at Princeton. And Schmidt himself has had an impressive career, getting his PhD at Harvard, winning the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics, and he's now the president of the Australian National University. By all accounts, if anyone would be a candidate for the genius label, it would be these two, but neither one of them identify with it. In fact, they agree it's a bit of a bad word among scientists and potentially even discouraging. In this interview that we are about to listen to, they talk about their successes and failures and what environments need to be created to encourage genius moments rather than geniuses.
This is, I think, going to be hopefully an illuminating session. So Sabrina and I are both physicists, but we are of a different generation. I am 52, she is 26, so she is half my age. 26 years ago, I finished my PhD at Harvard, and she's moving so fast that she is actually no longer a theoretical physicist at Harvard, because she's actually finished her PhD and has moved to Princeton.
Yeah.
So if you put all that together, you'd realize that when I was finishing my PhD, she was being born. So you're gonna get two people, a generation apart, thinking about what it means to recruit talent. And you've been asked, I hope, through Slido, to answer a question about recruiting geniuses. And as you do that, hopefully you put that in, I'm going to start off a little bit. Sabrina, I think you would have been a bit of a precocious child. You learned to fly an airplane at 13, is that right?
I had started flight lessons when I was like 9. They let little kids go in planes, and then I got to fly by myself when I was just turning 14 in Canada.
Yeah. Right, okay, so that's a good start. I first met you in 2012, and the fact that I remember meeting you in 2012 tells the audience something. You were introduced to me by a fellow Nobel Prize winner, Dudley Hirschbach, who was the first Nobel Prize winner I ever met, believe it or not, back in 1990, I think. And you were 19, you were in Lindau. I think you were the youngest person at Lindau, as I recall. And you were had just started at MIT studying, wanting to study aerospace engineering. Is that right?
So I had already transferred to, or like, you know, majored in physics, declared that. But when I went to MIT, I definitely like was interested in the institute because I was like thinking I was going to do aerospace engineering and be part of this like private aerospace thing that's still not quite there yet. but I kind of just fell in love with my physics class in the first year freshman requirements and just took it from there.
So 7 years later, we meet again here, very near where we met 7 years ago. You have straight A's at MIT, which I can tell you is not easy to do. You finished a PhD in string theory. And you're going to tell us just a little bit about what your PhD was in just a second, but to an astronomer, string theory is what we would call a dark art, and it's a dark art because it's completely opaque except for to those people who actually do it. So tell us exactly what your thesis was about, to give people a flavor of what you do.
So in practice, even though we all go under like this like string theory umbrella, normally the actual research is like string theory adjacent. So the work that I work on is feeding off of, I guess 20 years ago, Juan Maldacena had this conjecture of this duality between a theory of quantum gravity and a theory without gravity that was one dimension lower, and it had this conformal invariance. So now go back to 6 years ago, and a group at Harvard, we were working on, or still are working on, trying to make an analog of that for asymptotically flat space-time. So we pretend the cosmological constant is zero, zero for me. Like, the ADS guys were negative, so we're, like, going on, like, or, like, going the, what we wanted to do was essentially try to have this duality between scattering in 4D and two-dimensional conformal field theory, and essentially build up currents in that theory from soft theorems in quantum field theory in 4D.
Okay, so I think the audience has got a sense of what she's doing, okay? Yeah. Now, it is incredibly challenging. How did you make... Let me just start. I noticed that we have someone here from Poland. There's a picture of you on the front page of a Polish magazine. We had, from my perspective, Stephen Hawking talking about some of your work, which you did during your PhD, you know, as single author papers. You're clearly someone who's making a way, you know, a name for themselves in a really hard field, right? I cannot emphasize how hard it is to make a name for yourself in string theory. So I guess the question is, do people come up and call you a genius?
Definitely not who are like physicists. I mean, I think the thing is the media tries to latch on to certain labels to, like, you want to emphasize something as important. So rather than try to explain this like very like intricate and beautiful field, you like pick out people and say that they're cool because it's easier to sell that. Like, I think that, like, I still have to make a name for myself within my field, and it's just interesting that, like, the stuff that my advisor worked on was something where if you, instead of going to infinity, you go to horizons, then you can say something about black hole information, maybe, but, like, that was the idea that Hawking and him had. So, like, these things, like, you can make a story that sounds like this hero story, but really you're just, like, one of many people working on these stuff. And so, like, within my field, no one would ever come up to me and be like, oh, you know.
Right, and if someone does call you a genius, what's your reaction?
It's just like, oh no, I talked to the wrong person.
No one in our field likes being called a genius. It's a dirty word. So I'm curious to see how people have voted about whether or not you go out to hire geniuses, because you go out and hire geniuses, you're not going to hire her, you're not going to hire me, or anyone like us, because it's a word that we're... It's a word that we are not, I think, comfortable with. And partially it's because the notion of being a genius, I think, is different in 2019. To my mind, a genius is a name for someone who thinks they're smart. It's sort of a self-identified thing. It's for someone who thinks they're smart, and often are, but maybe is particularly difficult to deal with, as someone who runs a university. I don't know, is that consistent with your sense of what a genius would be these days?
I think that we tend to look at the work that people do. I mean, like, there's like something like genius about different like ideas that people have, but associating a person with it, like, we normally, even the best amongst us, like, we would never normally use that word because, well, first of all, I mean, like, say someone has done just so much more work, like, interesting work than you have, like, trying to categorize them as somebody other than you, like, they are genius and you are not, doesn't help anybody because, like, then, like, oh, I'll never do that. So, like, it discourages in a weird way. And then also, nobody would ever have to say they're great if they are doing good work, like, because, like, you acknowledge it. So.
Right. So, but you would agree probably that there are genius moments. So... Yeah. In your area, if I think Ed Witten, who would be one of, he's sort of the king of string theory, I think is a good reason to think. Yeah. So would you say that he had a genius moment in creating string theory, or a series of genius moments?
I'd say a series, because I mean, like it was still like many people developing string theory, but like, so the different results that he's had, yes. But yeah, I mean, and the thing is that I think, like, at least that... it's interesting to see, like, what it was that they knew, or like how those ideas originated, because you hope to find inspiration in that. Like, what can I learn now that's maybe slightly different than like just the standard track, so that I can have new insights? Because a lot of times it's just like somehow things were seen differently, and that's really cool. And like, how do you reproduce that?
So just thinking along the track of Ed Witten and, you know, what you're trying to do, you've now moved to Princeton. You've been at MIT, you've been at Harvard, you've been at Princeton, and that's sort of the big three for theoretical physics of at least the East Coast of the United States. I'll be careful to my friends down the West Coast of the United States. So you've clearly had sort of a normal upbringing in the Midwest in Chicago.
Yeah.
And you've gone, so let's talk about how you've made that transition from something which is, quite frankly, probably more mundane than I do, aerospace engineering, to something which is probably more exalted than what I do, which is string theory. So what did MIT do as when you were an undergraduate to help you make what is quite an extraordinary transition?
Yeah. So one thing about aerospace, I mean, like the side of aerospace that I was in when I was just like taking flying lessons is hardly aerospace engineering, and then like putting a kit plane together, right? Like you put the work in and then you have this like thing you've created out. So you feel like proud of something that you can then use, or like you do something. And then theoretical physics tends to be a bit different from that in the sense that whether or not like you end up having these like big picture ideas that you're like fortunate to be studying, you're still like just writing papers and stuff like that. So I liked MIT in the sense that it was, they always like you were always busy, you always had something to do, you always had something to compute, everything was just like the next step ahead of what you didn't like know yet, that you were like able to climb that ladder. I think that I was fortunate that I was at MIT because, I mean, grad school is also just very different than undergrad. Like you have like this like freedom, you have 6 years, you wanna like study this one thing in detail, come up with something new, go. And it's very open-ended. So I think that especially transitioning from like not being a very like a little kid who wanted to be a theoretical physicist, so I didn't like read Feynman lectures or whatnot as before entering undergrad, it was nice to be in a situation where it's like do these things and then like a coach essentially making you better.
Yeah. Right. So it's actually quite it's more constrained, and then you talk about going to graduate school and suddenly you're in with a bunch of smart people, you're trying to do something that no one's ever done before. So did you find that harder than undergraduate?
I think it's harder in a like in a different way. So like MIT, I was always like pressured, right? And so it can be hard, but like, you can rise to the occasion or what. I'm sure like a lot of people can if they choose to value certain things. Like I did well with grades and because I cared about that, and other people did cool projects and that maybe is cooler. Once you get to grad school, you realize like that like you have to do a lot of things that are not going to like reward you in some weird way, but like you know that you need them. And it's difficult, not so much like in the day-to-day, but just like being able to take a step back and know exactly what you need to do and like have this like not get lost in, oh, I want to learn everything a little bit, or like I need to know this thing well, but then I ended up not needing it. So that's what's difficult. I think it's just because it's an ill-posed problem normally that you have.
So you finished your PhD, you've decided to go to Princeton. I know Princeton is a great place to do theoretical physics. Why did you choose to go to Princeton?
It's for my subfield, being at Harvard or being in the Princeton area is like the best places to be around other people working on the same stuff. And I think, or not the exact same stuff, which is good. So it's nice to be like not just near my advisor and the people who've worked with him, so I can like get ideas from other adjacent subfields. So that's kind of why.
So despite writing your own important papers, a solo or you know, with a small number of authors, having people around you who you can talk to is still an important part of your career thus far?
It's super important to have so if you think about it, the amount of knowledge that you'd have to really be able to like push up to whatever frontier any field is in is just too much for a single person to really have command over. And also having other people like who can like supplement that or teach you things and like you can at least like extract what's relevant versus like what are the details, because that person knows something else really well, is just essential to basically making any progress in a very theoretical field.
So you're in that beautiful time, the first 3 or 4 months of your postdoc. Everything's happy. You haven't started worrying about your next job.
Yeah.
But people, my experience the world over, start getting a little antsy about whether or not they're going to be able to stay in the field and what exactly it is that you're looking for. So are you going to take the first job that's offered to you anywhere in the world under any circumstance?
No, I really want to. I mean, like, so 3 years is so short, and I think that's the funny thing that changed after undergrad is, like, I spent 3 years in undergrad, and that was, like, a long time for me, and it's amazing just, like, how once you are just, like, in a problem and like thinking about things, and then you need to learn all these other things. Like time just flies. So the like first, like for this first year, I'm trying to pretend that it's in like 3 years is forever, right? And just do good work. And I think you try to tell yourself, like, I don't want to be jumping around doing postdoc to postdoc. At some point, you'll think you'll know whether or not what you're doing is going to be significant or interesting enough, like, to your field that you should be there long, like, forever, right? So I'm kind of giving myself a deadline, but...
But what do you think is going to be the characteristics? So let's assume you keep on the way you're going, mm-hmm. you keep on making your discoveries. What do you think is going to be... So I'm a vice chancellor. What does ANU have to do to make... to get you to come down to Australia and work for us?
Tell
me what it's going to take.
I think 3 years from now, that's going to be just anything. No. That's the thing is, like, you fall in love with what you're working on, and you want to, like, keep being able to work on this thing. But and when you're further away from the deadlines, you're like, I have standards, you know, like, or whatever. Like, not standards as far as, like, any university is great, but, like, you have certain things you want. Like, you want to be near, like, New York City or something. Like, just, like you wish you had these things if you could have anything. And then you realize, like, oh, I'd rather just be doing this. And then, like, you'll take literally anything. But
you're likely to be in a power, so you're going to have some options.
I don't know. Like, you like to think you have this power. You have to earn that power if you have any, or, like, I don't know. It's such a weird setup. I think it's good that you can, like, let as many people, or a lot of people, into the PhD programs because, right, you're letting them spend, like, 6 years of their life studying something they like. But then the weird thing about it is in that process, you realize, like, it becomes a tunnel vision with, like, the only thing I could possibly do is be a professor. And then you realize, oh, shoot, like, all of us who are in grad school getting a PhD want to be professors, and how many professors are they hiring? Like, eh. And then you tell yourself, I'm going to be the one who's at, like, name some institutions, and I wouldn't take the other ones. But then you see these great people taking the other ones because you realize this is just a shitty job market.
I more or less said that yesterday in different terms, but yes. Yeah. So, okay, so in the end, do you think you can thrive in your work going to, let's just say, that a university that doesn't do any string theory or theoretical high energy physics, do you think you can land there and do a great job, or do you think you need to have a different type of environment?
I think that it's getting better. Like, I have collaborators who were at Harvard with me, and now they're in Europe, and because of Skype and, like, whatever, FaceTime, whatever chat programs you have, you can interact with those people. I think that the structure, like, to make... So it's almost like you basically, like, take advantage of the fact that there are openings at, like, lots of universities, like, all over that maybe aren't as centralized, and then you take those positions, you use the funding from that, and then you go to, like, a lot of workshops and then try to meet collaborators at, like Flatiron Institute or some other, like, maybe Stony Brook. And that model, you can kind of see it working. I think that it's something that's going to improve over time. So you could imagine a situation where it's not a big deal that you're literally isolated, as long as you're not intellectually isolated. But I think that maybe because it's still changing and evolving, like, I've still been biased by wishing that I wasn't like alone. I think it'd be very hard to simulate, like, actually, like, the whole day having conversations with people in related fields. I think that you can handle it for, like, the summer. You can go to workshops or you can have collaborators, but making sure those things start and, like, stay alive would be still rather difficult when you're not near the person.
So would you agree that in your field, as mathematical as it is, that creativity is an important bit, that it's not just grinding through the numbers, but you need to have some sort of creative insight?
I mean, that's the fun part, at least. So it's always also kind of ironic that you think that you're going to have this great insight when you're just, like, reading lots of, like, I mean, like, the material behind what you didn't know, and it's going to click. I've found that even though it's, like, so this is not, like, it's not great, but it's great for me when I'm, like, working on a problem and you're doing these, like just the details and you know how to do the computation, then is where you, like, that's when you find inspiration for something that you just misunderstood. Oftentimes it's because maybe the computation was straightforward but actually wasn't, like, so I would say that the mechanics of doing the problems just makes sure that, like, enforces the understanding and gives you maybe some, it, like, takes your mind off of other distractions so that you can be creative or something like that, but it's not the creativity itself.
So in terms of the environment around you, so what is the environment that you're looking for to be creative?
Coffee. And
coffee, yes.
Open my, like, people who, they know enough about something related to what you do to ask questions that make you, like, second guess yourself a little bit. Like, right, so you want somebody who can, like, be harder on you a little bit than you would be to yourself, but somehow nice enough that they don't just crush you.
Yep. So it's sort of a highly social collaborative network somehow, and coffee.
Yeah.
I mean, so I'll be honest, at ANU, we're putting coffee cafes and really high quality coffee. I love Switzerland, but they got a long ways to go on coffee compared to
but
Australia.
But the chocolate's good.
The chocolate is superb. I'll give you that. So chocolate is also good as well. So that workplace which allows you to interact with colleagues in a in a frank but friendly manner.
Yeah.
Maybe not dissimilar to what we saw in the previous panel. So that's really important. I think is what you would see.
Yeah.
Do you, what about the notion of this uncertainty? So we tend to put someone like you maybe through postdoc one, postdoc two, postdoc three. I promise you, your life tends to get more complicated as you get older, at least in my own experience. Is that something that's that tension, that meat grinder going to make you better or is it going to make you worse at your job, do you think?
I think that there is something to this either like not, like you, I think you actually have to not care. I mean, like saying you don't care isn't the same thing as actually not caring about the fact that there are these deadlines because I don't know, it seems like, I mean, a lot of the people who do great, like the people that you're most impressed with, like when you run into them in the hallway, I feel like they're just only concerned about the problems that they're working on and not so much like these other details. And that level of focus, I think, is hindered sometimes when you have these deadlines coming up. But like if you can just recreate like this state of mind where you don't think about that too much, then the work should guide you. And then I think as like when you're a newbie and you haven't like had enough time in the field to really feel that you have already not like made a name for yourself, then you try to imagine that I'm gonna like not have to do three postdocs or whatnot. So for you, you also had a similar situation where you thought you were gonna like not.
Yeah, no. So I moved to Australia with a 4-year project and a 3-year job, and ended up not getting my job continued because I finished fourth in the job. So I kept on doing it, thinking I was gonna go do something else, and in the end, conveniently, the three people in front of me turned the job down, and I got to fight another day. I started that job on the 1st of January, 1998, and I realized the universe was accelerating on the 8th of January, 1998. So it was a very close run thing for me, if you think about it. Now, the audience, you've got Slido. You can start asking questions as well. So just go on, and happy to take them as we go along. So if I could do one thing for you or for people like you, think of your cohorts. Yeah. One thing that the university president or vice chancellor can do to help people at your career stage, what's the one thing we could do?
I think, or promise more jobs, I mean. No, I mean, as far as like literally, like if you could do anything, you had infinite resources. I think that, so when I was a grad student, maybe what would have been fun was if like the postdocs, for instance, thought that their chances of getting this permanent position relied more heavily on how much they mentor grad students. Because I feel like the one thing is like when you have great advisors and they're senior and they have so many commitments, and they may be overloaded with students and the students can't necessarily like just learn like some like small details from them. You often try to find like a network of other grad students studying the same stuff or postdocs who know the stuff and are willing to take on this grad student. And a lot of that is not very structured necessarily in grad school, because it's up to you to do it. I think that that could be improved, and it's hard to say exactly how, but essentially making the technical mentoring, taking some of the burden off of the advisors and having some more structure to that aspect of grad school would help, at least like for theorists, like a lot. Because the thing is that you're studying something that's been developed very like in depth for maybe 30 years or so, and has like is disconnected from experiment. So like there's nothing just like surprising that we have to now attack, right? So you have this huge like glacier of knowledge that you're like trying to like outrun or what, I don't know, whatever. Like you essentially like need help, I think, and I think that system could be improved. What do you think? What would you do? Like, what do you think?
Well, so I guess what I'm trying to do is provide people like you a block of time for security, where you don't have to worry about the job. So, really trying to go away from 1 or 2 year contracts, trying to get people to do 3 to 5 year contracts, but also taking a fairly hard line and being honest with people and saying, you know, if you're not in a tenure track job after the first 5 years, maybe it's time, your early enough career, to change directions. And for us to try to create a career structure which is at least tenable for people, where they get very clear signals and they're still beneficial and they're not, I would say, burning time with a very low probability. Yeah. So trying to give people a great time when they're with us, but then very clear signals as early on in their career. So, you know, sort of, you're 26 now, so by the time you're 30, you'd have a pretty good clear time. Yes, you're in a tenure track job. So that's what I'm trying to do. And to also make sure that when you come, there's no second-class citizens, that when you come, you get the resources you need to do good work. And you don't try to maximize the number of people and make them starve. You actually give them a real healthy environment as best as possible. So I think that is an important feature. So we have our first question, and so I'm going to reward that with asking it. Universities must educate geniuses differently than regular students. So, okay, so we're not going to call you a genius, but did you get a different education than your peers?
When I was in elementary school, I went to a gifted school. I mean, like, Mr. Chicago did this. Like, definitely. I think that there's something about, I mean, I don't think it's accurate, like whatever IQ like test they have you take, like you feel special and you're like, I can do anything. And your parents tell you the same thing and you're like, yeah. And I just wish everybody thought that they were a genius to some extent, but then like thought they had to not talk about it so that like it's not like like over the top. Because like there is something about feeling that like this is the right thing for you. I think that maybe one thing I would argue is like universities should help you find the right major for you, because I think that there are some things that come more naturally to some people than others, and like pointing that out, like that this is your thing and encouraging that is good. I think that like excluding people from something is not good. Like so definitely I do not think that like that type of classification is a healthy thing. But I think that like university should strive to have like material for whoever is ready to eat, like consume it next. And sometimes it's not because the person is like way more like intelligent. It's just because they've studied this thing for like in elementary school or whatever, or in high school, and they come in knowing more, and you have to be ready for that. But doesn't mean that you should say, oh, this person's like way better than this other student. It's just this person has 10 years on this student, you know?
So as someone who's very strong in their field, one of the things I talked to you last night about is, are you just going to keep doing string theory, or are you going to branch out? And so this kind of goes to this next question, which is, do universities allow you to branch out enough, or do we just focus you down into one little thing where you become great? How do we manage that from your perspective?
I think that universities sell themselves on being interdisciplinary, right? Like that's like...
Well, we sell ourselves, but right. From your perspective, do we seem very interdisciplinary?
How is it? I think that... For some stuff, it works. I think if everybody tries to do everything, it does not work. I think you can see where there are emerging intersections of field, like maybe biophysics, or I mean, like not for me, but like definitely there are some subfields that kind of have like had their new day, like now, and those are interdisciplinary. But I think at some point, once they become like full fledged departments, then they become less interdisciplinary. So I think that. I would say that they encourage this open mind, but maybe like you need to be specialized enough to then like actually have tools that you can apply to another field, rather than starting from the beginning saying you're going to do this thing unless someone else has already shown that connection is fruitful.
All right, so I realize this is a 30-minute session, so we've run out of time. So I think it's worthwhile reflecting, since we had so much philosophy in the previous session, and I'm going to take it back to American philosophy, which I grew up with, and my philosopher is Groucho Marx, who said, the one thing that the world is never short of is idiots. And I think one of the roles that, at least in, for me running a university, is making sure that we bring people of talent, and I think we've talked about that genius is maybe not a term we like to use, but by getting people of diverse range of talents, including people who do string theory, and supporting them, you can create genius moments. And hopefully those genius moments are enough to offset the idiots that seem to perhaps be in abundance more than we would like. So let's thank Sabrina, and thank you.
And that was Brian Schmidt, president of the Australian National University, interviewing physicist Sabrina Pisterski. Thanks very much for listening to this podcast. If you've got any suggestions or comments you'd like to make, you can get in touch with me, sarah.custer@timeshighereducation.com. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.